So welcome everybody for this evening's talk. As Dennis was mentioning, I was just came back from another trip overseas. I was here last Friday, Saturday left to go to Singapore and Kuala Lumpur and to give some talks, came back Thursday morning. But just one interesting thing, I'm going to ramble a bit this evening, but the main topic of the talk is dealing with the complexities of life, and especially those in the past. It's a topic which I thought I've dealt with a few times, but it keeps on coming back in both here and in Singapore and Malaysia, when people were asking just how Buddhism can actually deal with the difficulties which each one of us have faced, and some of those are very traumatic difficulties. But I wanted to first of all let you know of an interesting development that when I was in Singapore, I went to give the final talk at a Buddhist film festival. In many places in the world, it's our Waisak time now, celebrating the birth, enlightenment and final passing away of the Buddha. So there's ceremonies and festivals and events all over the world. So I went over to Singapore to give a talk at a Buddhist film festival. As usual, I make it up as I go along. And talking about something which I remembered as a long time ago, when I first became a monk about 36, 37 years ago in Thailand, someone showed me a copy of one of the Thai newspapers, and even though I couldn't understand Thai that well, I still, as I do these days, I like reading the comics. So I saw a comic there, and the comic was of a character called Super Monk. Now, it's 36, 37 years ago, so Super Monk was like a Superman or one of these superheroes. And Super Monk could levitate, of course, being a Super Monk. He could fly through the air, but also had these great powers to stop trains crashing and stop aircraft sort of plunging into the ground. He could save all these people from the bad guys. But unlike modern times when Superman or these other superheroes, they usually either kill the bad guys or send them into prison forever. In Super Monk comic, he would give them the five Buddhist precepts, and they'd become very good people afterwards, even they'd join the Sangha and become monks. It was a much nicer ending. And not violence, because sometimes even these superheroes, they use too much violence. Instead of using violence, using wisdom and compassion to solve the problems of the world. And what a wonderful idea that was. And so anyway, I mentioned that I see in the newspapers, you know, in the magazines, they've got all these superheroes I used to read about in the comics as a kid. Batman and Green Lantern and The Flash and all these other people. They always, Batman, they always make movies of these people now. And so the one movie which I thought they should have after the Buddhist Film Festival, a real Buddhist movie, would be Super Monk. Now, you know, I throw these ideas out, and sometimes you think I'm just, you know, wasting time. But when you go to these meetings, every now and again, you meet someone interesting. And at the end of my talk, somebody stood up, and they put their hand up for the question. They said, my ex-husband works for Steven Spielberg at DreamWorks. I'm going to email him tonight this suggestion. So if you see, in a 1 or 2 years' time, in the movies, Super Monk, done by DreamWorks, with the consultant as Ajahn Brahm, you know where it came from. But I thought, what a wonderful thing, because all these superheroes, they end up punishing the bad guys. And this world of when you do something wrong, you punish somebody. Or when you do something wrong, you have to do some sort of penance. I'm sure that you all know that keeps the psychiatrists and the therapists in business. But, now there is another way of dealing with that, and just another way of dealing with the terrorists, you know, and the sort of bad guys. If we punish them, put them in jail, does that ever stop the problem? And I must admit, I was very proud of our President Dennis Shepherd, who after the assassination or the death of Osama bin Laden, he wrote to our local paper here saying that maybe that wasn't the best thing to do. And of course, when I go overseas, people ask that question to me. And they said, you know, that just Kuala Lumpur a couple of days ago, Ajahn Brahm, what did you think about the killing of Osama? You know, you were a Buddhist monk. And as far as I'm concerned, just now, all that type of killing is not really going to do much good. All it's really saying to us is that if there's someone who we're really afraid of, if there's someone who's really a problem, just kill them. Put them out of our misery. And they say, yes, well, I mean, that's one terrorist, one person who can no longer kill. But what is the message we are giving to everybody? We're giving the message to everybody that violence is a way to solve problems. And of course, that violence will actually be in domestic violence in marriages. My husband, in many ways, is just like Osama bin Laden, the way he treats me. Or other people. And we all know there is so much violence in our society. And why do we have violence? Because we think the other person deserves it. They're just getting their just desserts. And because of that, we just perpetuate a terrible thing in our society of revenge. And again, one of the reasons I became a Buddhist as a young man, who was very concerned about the world in which I would spend the rest of my years, I just hated violence. It was maybe because I was a child whose parents had been through the Second World War. You know, my own mother had a bomb had landed in the house next to where she was a young girl. The people, now these were terraced houses. This is, you maybe see here in Perth, in the East Perth development, houses which just had one wall to divide them. And so sometimes you could hear the neighbours when they were arguing, and you could hear them when they turned on the radio, because there was only one brick wall dividing them. And because of that, you know, during the Second World War, you know, when a bomb from one of the aircraft of the enemy fell on the house next door. Next door meant next door. So the house next door, all the neighbours got blown to smithereens. My mother's very lucky. She just got her arm slashed with glass. And of course, the house was unlivable, but she survived. And of course, this was just the nearest experience which she had. But all the people from that violence, they carried the scars, maybe not the visible scars like my mother had, but the emotional scars. And maybe because of that, you know, as a young man, I thought there must be another way to violence and punishment and revenge. And that's why when you saw the Buddha's teachings, you know, of non-violence, of forgiveness, you realized that this was another possibility, another way. And I just embrace that way. And it's used it, not just in international relations, because I don't want to really focus on that now. Even in movies, you know, super monk, who doesn't go around killing people and punishing people, but just, you know, faces them, stops the danger, and starts to teach them there's another way of dealing with these things in life. And in particular, we also use that, and this is a focus of this evening's talk, you know, on, you know, the violence done to you and done by you in your past. Because each one of us comes with our history. And sometimes that history is not the most pleasant. And sometimes you could have been abused. You could have been sexually abused, physically abused in your youth. And what are we going to do about that? And because Buddhism is one of the few paths which does not celebrate revenge and makes a huge distinction between the ideas of justice and revenge, that I thought that was a beautiful path. And I've practiced that path, I've taught that path, and it's healed so many people. So, the complexities of your past, what are you going to do with them? In our society, we think we have to bring that up, deal with it, get justice, punish the perpetrators, because if we don't, they'll do it again to somebody else. And to me, that never made any sense. And to me, that it was much better to follow what I heard in the Buddha's teachings. Simple teachings which are actually very well known. Things like, he hurt me, he abused me, he cheated me. Hatred never ceases in a person who harbors such thoughts. That's straight from the Dhammapada. You know, he hurt me, or she abused me, or they cheated me. If you harbor those thoughts and keep them, the hatred, the pain never ends in you. So straight away from that, the Buddha said, no, stop those thoughts, let them go, it's the past, it's finished. And it was an amazing thing for me to realize that you could Just take all that pain of the past, and you could just let it go. You did not have to carry it around with you. And I teach in many conferences where many psychologists attend. And I've taught that here, and that is a very powerful statement, which is cutting edge, state of the art, which is not just bringing up the past, remembering it, going through it again, and again, and again, and again, but finding some way to actually to cut it all off in one go. And that's what the Buddha was suggesting. And the very suggestion of that showed just that 2,600 years ago when the Buddha became enlightened, according to our tradition, and to just to show that at that time there's no other person who under, or any religion, or anybody who understood the mind that thoroughly to even suggest that that's possible. I think it's very fair enough to say that psychology, you know, began with Buddhism. The understanding of the nature of the mind and effective ways of dealing with the pain and the problems and the troubles of the past. It started with that. And it inspired me. But how the heck can you do it? Is it possible? And of course, when I give these talks, I love personal anecdotes. And actually to bring these ideas down to earth. Because, you know, sometimes when you give a talk, it can be theoretical and people say, oh, that's all very good, it sounds inspiring, but look, we have to live in the real world. How the heck does this work? And of course, personal stories. I had a very good childhood, so I can't use my own personal story, but I love to use the story of my own father. And I've told this story before, but I mean, it's a powerful story that my father was born in Liverpool. And it must have been just after the First World War. So he grew up in what they call the Depression years. And he called this, you know, the GFC, the Global Financial Crisis. I mean, that's nothing compared to what happened in those early days when people really were starving. When people didn't have enough to eat. And when you go to work, and you're lucky if you kept to work that day. And during those Depression years, I mean, my father used to talk about them. My grandfather used to talk about them. Just, you know, not knowing. And there's no sort of social security payments from the government. You know, there's no safety net at all. Some people died. You know, no place to live. Starvation. Your kids, you know, which, you know, you had when good times, you didn't have any money left to look after them in those bad times. It was really, really tough. And my father, who grew up in those years, used to tell me about his father, my paternal grandfather, who did have work. He was a plumber. You could always find some work somewhere as a plumber. But when he did get paid, life was just so depressing. There was no real future, no real hope. You know, if he had a sexual relationship with my paternal grandmother, it was just another kid, another person to feed in the house, another burden. No contraception in those days. And so that his life was going to work and then just going to the pub afterwards and coming back drunk almost every night. And what my father used to say, that as soon as he heard his father, you know, his father, my paternal grandfather, coming back, he would hide, try to get out of the way. Because my father would take off his leather belt and just whip any kid who came in the way. And then visit abuse on his mother who could not escape from him. A really gross, violent, domestic abuse. A drunken man with no hope. And that's my father describing his upbringing. And it was why it took me many years to get that out of my dad. Because, you know, as a son, you always want to say, what was your mother and father like? You know, what did you do? I was interested in my roots. And that's why it took him many years, actually, to tell me how he grew up. But I remember him telling me, so he said that many times when he was on the end of that belt, getting a whipping for nothing he did. He didn't deserve any punishment. He was just a drunken father with no hope. He said he made a determination, a resolution. He said to me that every time that belt dug into his flesh, he remembered that one day I might have kids. And if ever I have children, I will never, ever treat them that way. And of course, many years later, he survived. Many years later, he met my mother, and I was one of the two children he had. And he was one of the most softest of men. Even if I did misbehave, he just could not hit me. And I didn't know why at the time, but now, of course, I understand why. Because of that resolution, he knew how much it hurt. Not just physically, I mean emotionally. And he realized that's not the way to bring up a kid. And I think you'll all agree I turned out pretty well. And that's the sort of father I had, who wasn't going to visit violence on me. My brother as well, you know, he's a couple of years older than me, a really good man, he's retired now. And because that he had abuse, and very gross abuse, it wasn't that he could take that abuse and visit it on his kids. It never went past his generation. Why? Because he looked at that abuse. He acknowledged it, you know, what it actually was. And when he realized how much it hurt, he had enough wisdom and compassion to say, no, I will never do that on anybody else. Sometimes when we are abused, when we are hurt, can't we use that same idea that how much it hurts, how much pain it causes us, how much sense of a lack of trust, that's someone I loved who was hurting me so much. Can't we learn from that? And instead of visiting justice on somebody else, they hurt me, I have to hurt somebody else, but actually say, I am never going to do the same to anybody else. I know what it feels like. I know how it hurts. I'm never going to do that to anybody else. What is happening there is a standard thing which I understood from Buddhism. We acknowledge the pain. We forgive it. We don't want to punish back. But we learn from it. We learn, we grow. We become much, much better people as a result. And my father did understand love. And he did show that love to me. He did teach me how to love, even though he came from such a terrible background. What it told to me is true. He did practice that Buddhist teaching. He hurt me, he abused me, he cheated me, talking about his own father. But my hatred, the ill will not get solved, it won't get healed if I keep thinking about that. So he let that go. So he never needed to visit violence upon me. It is this way that we deal with the pain of our past. Of course, the first thing is the acknowledgement. We don't hide it. We don't deny things. Honesty, truth is the first part of any real spiritual path. You can't have a religion which is based on just fantasies and dreams and things which aren't true at all. Again, that's one of the other things which I value with Buddhism. Truth is valued more than being right. If you understand what I mean there. Because sometimes I am the leader, I am the boss, I know more than anybody else, I am right. And sometimes authority figures who feel they're right stand in the way of truth. Truth has nothing to do with being right. Truth is actually learning to look deeper, and as soon as someone thinks they're right, it means you don't look any deeper. So truth is always work in progress. Being right is dogma where you stop any more investigation, any more questioning, any more learning. Once you are right, we're finished with our investigation. But truth is something which we will never actually reach in the sense of being right, was always look deeper, find more, understand more. That's what truth is all about. When you think you're right, that's where we get dogma. When truth, it's always we can look a little bit deeper, find out a bit more, learn some more. So because of that I always realize that we do acknowledge, we do investigate, we do find out what's happening. We don't hide anything. Denial has nothing to do with Buddhism. So we acknowledge, we're honest. Now the fourth precept of honesty is not just not telling lies to other people. It's not telling lies to yourself. Being honest to who you are, what you are, as best you know, and going deeper. So once we have that acknowledgement, of course that's always the first step. And you know, I mean, one of the talks which I had to give, because people choose the talks for me, and I prefer it when you ask me to give a talk, I prefer it when somebody even chooses a topic. Because, you know, otherwise, number one, I'm not challenged, I just choose the old talks. And number two, you don't connect with people when you talk about what I want to talk about, what you want to talk about. And in Malaysia, they asked me to give a talk on a subject which I never talked on before because I didn't know what the heck they meant, on Muhibah. And Muhibah, I landed in Kuala Lumpur and I was going to give a 3-hour session that afternoon on Muhibah. So the first thing I had to do is, what the heck is Muhibah? And it is a Malay word for harmony and bringing together the different communities in Malaysia, because there's 4 big communities in Malaysia. There's the Malays, the Chinese, the Indians, and the rest, which is mostly the indigenous people, you know, and a few sort of Westerners and other sort of communities there. But they're the 4 communities. And if you ever watch politics or in Malaysia, there's a few people who grew up in Malaysia or have relations in Malaysia, you know that, you know, here in our Buddhist society, you know there's a great tension between those 4 communities which flares up every now and again. They ask me, but how can you actually bridge those 4 communities and have a bit more harmony? And of course, one of the things I was saying, first of all, be honest. Why you dislike those people? So I got them to write down on a piece of paper the reasons they don't like, first of all, the Malays, then the Indians, then the Chinese, which most of them were, why they don't like themselves. In other words, be honest to your faults and your weaknesses. And then, of course, you know, the old technique, now write the things you like about those other communities, what you respect about the Malays, what you respect about the Indians, what you respect about... You know, one of the things I really respect about the Indians over in Malaysia, my goodness, they make a delicious cup of tea. And, you know, Indian tea, you know, with, you know, really strong, lots of condensed milk. Oh, I love that stuff. So anyway, they wrote down all the things they liked about it. So what they were doing, they were being honest, but they were also being balanced. And of course, it's that balance to another community which is how we can deal with our past, by being balanced to our past. Because my father, yeah, he was beaten by my grandfather, but he was also fed, brought up and protected by him at times. There was another side to the story. And seeing the other side to the story, not just the pain of the past, but the pleasant part of the past, is one of the most important means of actually letting it go. He hurt me, he abused me, he cheated me. Ill will, anger, that guilt, that pain, that trauma will never be let go of if you harbor such thoughts. So how do you let go of that? You're truthful to that, you're honest to that, but your honesty also sees the other side of the story. He was kind to me. He cared for me. He looked after me, as well as he beat me. Then it's possible to let go. It's possible to let go because we realize it's worth letting go. As some people have often asked, how on earth do you forgive someone? Say like Osama bin Laden, if you were one of the people who lost your closest relationship, you know, in the Twin Towers or wherever else was destroyed on September 11th. Suppose that was your mother or your kid and they died in that. And they were just going to work. They didn't do anything. They're not involved in politics. They're not sort of Muslim, Christian or whatever. They're just an ordinary person who went to work one morning and they were killed because of this damn Osama bin Laden. And sometimes, you know, you can understand why people just would celebrate such a death. Simply because they're not seeing the big picture. They wanted revenge. They've never forgiven. And I think you know what happens. Such people, even the death of, say, Osama bin Laden, still it's not ended yet. They want to kill everybody. Have you ever noticed that justice in the form of revenge never ends a matter? It never settles the matter forever. It's even in the heart of the person who really suffered. If that was, say, you know, your child who got killed, and they found the killer, and even if they executed him, your pain hasn't ended yet. It's still there. The idea of justice has been done, now I can get on with my life. No, you can't, because that does not work. But the other way of forgiveness, people have often asked me, how on earth do you forgive when someone has hurt you so badly? Or they've destroyed your life, or they've stopped everything. The other way is being honest. Really much more honest than you have ever done before. And see the good side in that character as well. See the nice side in a person like Osama. Unfortunately, you never read about that in newspapers, but it would be wonderful. It would be a very challenging piece to actually, for someone to actually to write all the wonderful, beautiful things which Osama bin Laden did in his life. The kindness, the love which he gave to his kids or to whoever. And I'm sure that's there, as it is in everybody. And it's a tough thing to do because we've stereotyped. We've judged without having the information. We've already decided that that person is bad, they've got no redeeming qualities at all. And that type of judgment means forgiveness is not possible. For that forgiveness and that moving on, we've got to see something beautiful, wonderful, good, something we can respect in our enemy. And once that step is made, and that is the hardest step, the rest is easy. You realize he wasn't such a bad guy. He did some terrible things. Incredibly terrible things, but there's another part of him which you haven't even thought could exist. Once you see that, then you can let go. Once you see the other part in the person who's hurt you, cheated you, abused you, you see another part in them, then you can forgive. You know, when you forgive, it doesn't take away the pain of the past. It just frees you from the pain of the past. In other words, you can learn from it, you can grow from it, you can understand why these things happen. Why there was a man who beat my father for no reason. Why there was a man who thought it was worthwhile blowing up people for some sort of good cause. Why it was that people cheated you. Why it was that your partner was unfaithful to you. Why it was that somebody let you. Why it was that people accused you of something you did not do and destroyed your reputation. Why did they do that? Once you understand the reason why, now I know, then forgiveness can happen. Once that forgiveness happens, then there can be freedom from the past. And it's not just forgiving people who've hurt you. It's also forgiving yourself, because both of these go together. People who are angry at others are guilty about themselves. And I've seen that so often. Little kids who come to you and say they're worthless, they're bad, right inside. These are the suicidal kids in our community. Just talking with Dennis about them earlier. Why on earth do kids think like that? And again, it's because of our society. One of the reasons which wants justice, which wants revenge. Yes, other people are bad. They need to be destroyed. So if you look at yourself and think you're bad, then I need to be destroyed. And that type of problem creates a huge amount of psychological pain. And I think each one of you may have actually sometimes felt that there's something wrong with you. You're a bad person. Why? Because all these things have happened to you. I must be bad. I must be really terrible. Why did this thing happen to me? And of course, that anger, that depression, which is focused on yourself, is called guilt. And for all of those psychological impasses, that to me is the most stupid. Feeling guilty about something you've done. And why do you do that? Number one, it doesn't make any sense. I'm a rationalist. I was a scientist. Because sometimes you feel guilty. It means you think, what did I do? Why did I do it? I should have done it another way. Sometimes you don't know if you could have done it another way. You don't know what might have happened if you did something else. Just the past is so old, and you don't know what might have happened. So it probably might have been a good thing which you did. I don't know. I'm going to bring up this old story again. I told this about 6 weeks ago. You know, this is a good story for those who haven't heard it before. And this is one of those stories which you can use in your daily life. Talk to other people. It solves a lot of problems. It was a story of the king who went hunting. You know, this is a good, bad, who knows story. A golden oldie, but it's so powerful. King went hunting, and when he was hunting, he scratched his finger. And when he scratched his finger, there was a doctor in his entourage. And so he called the doctor over. Doctor, my finger's been scratched. Can you please have a look at it? And the doctor looked at it and just put a band-aid on it. And the king said, is it going to be okay? It's my finger. As you would ask a doctor, is it going to be okay? And the doctor said, good, bad, who knows? That's pretty wise, isn't it? But you know, it didn't impress the king that much. So when he got back to the palace after enjoying himself on the hunt, by that time the finger was red, it was infected. So the king called the doctor over again and said, doctor, look at my finger, it's got worse. And so the doctor took the band-aid off, put some ointment on and put a proper bandage, you know, cleaned it up, put a bandage on. And of course the king asked again, is it going to be okay? Is it okay? And the doctor, he said, good, bad, who knows? So the king was a bit perturbed, but he's very busy, so he just let the stupid doctor go away. But a couple of days later, I mean, his finger was so bad, you know, that the doctor had to amputate it. That's how infected it was. And of course, you know, if that happened to you, you'd sue the doctor. You know, you'd get a lawyer and take them to court or whatever and get some compensation. In those days, it wasn't suing. He just put that doctor in prison in the bottom of the palace. And he put the doctor in prison himself. So, you stupid doctor, look what's happened to my finger. All this good, bad, who knows business. And so what do you think about that then, eh, being in jail? And know what the doctor replied to the king, being in jail? Good, bad, who knows? Ah, crazy doctor, you can rot in there. So they left the doctor in jail. And of course, you know, a couple of weeks later, when his finger was healed, he went back to his favourite pastime, hunting in the forest. And this time he was a bit heedless. He was following some sort of animal and got separated from the rest of his entourage and got lost in the forest. Lost in the forest, wandering around, he actually got captured by these forest people, these indigenous people. And they were sort of totally sort of beyond his control. They didn't know he was a king. They just captured him. And it happened to be one of their holy days. So they took him to the priest to be sacrificed to their god, a human sacrifice. So they tied him up. And the priest was doing all the mumbo jumbo and the dancing up and down and stuff. And then he got out this sacrificial knife and was about to, you know, slit the king's throat. And it was only the last moment, the very last moment, that the priest realized the king was missing a finger. And he said, stop everybody. If we make a sacrifice to our God, we have to sacrifice somebody perfect. He's not perfect enough. He's missing one finger. Set him free. So because he lost one finger and he wasn't perfect enough to be sacrificed to a God, they set him free. And he realized, that doctor, what a wise man he was. I lost a finger, I thought it was bad, but it actually was good. Because if I had all my 10 fingers, I'd be dead by now. So as soon as he found his way back to the prison, he went back to the palace, he went straight to the prison, straight to the doctor's cell, and opened the lock himself and said, you're free. I'm so sorry what I did. No, you were right. And he told him the story, and he said, it was good I lost my finger, otherwise I wouldn't be here today. I'd be dead, sacrificed. But the doctor was remorseful. He felt so guilty about what he did to that doctor. So he asked for apology and said, I'm terribly sorry, please forgive me. It's a bad thing I did, throwing you into jail like that. At which point the doctor said, what do you mean, a bad thing that you did? It was good that I was in jail. And I'll tell you why. If you hadn't thrown me in jail, I would have been there on that hunt. I would have been captured too. And I've got my 10 fingers. So that's a wonderful story which I've told before here. But isn't it true? Good, bad, who knows? So those things which happened to you in the past are those things which you did, which you feel so guilty about or feel angry about if they happened to you. Why do you do that? Because you think it was a bad thing you did. If you're wise and you understood that story, it doesn't matter what you did, good, bad, who knows? What would have happened if you'd taken another path? What would have happened if someone had not cheated on you? What would have happened if my girlfriend sort of hadn't liked another boy? I thought it was a very bad, she was my girlfriend, but she told me she was interested in another boy. Was that bad? I thought it was bad at the time, but now I know it was good. I escaped so closely. Oh, that was really a close call. You know, I could have been, you know, on my third marriage with kids and mortgages and a headache. But now I'm a monk, I'm free. So if I ever find that girl again, I say, oh, thank you so much for dumping me. So all the stuff which you get angry about, you think that someone's hurt you, abused you, cheated you. What a wonderful way of looking at it. Good, bad, who knows? If it wasn't for that pain, maybe I wouldn't be who I am today. I wouldn't have learned so much. I wouldn't have grown so much. I wouldn't have had the opportunity to understand so deeply about life. You know, because wise people, they don't go through life just, you know, with a silver spoon in their mouth and having a wonderful time. Because you know that wisdom is actually born just in the pain of life, in the difficulties, in the troubles. That's where we become wise. And just what is the most wonderful thing to actually to learn, just how to forgive and how to love unconditionally. So all the pain you've had in the past, all the difficulties, all the trauma, this is actually what I've said, the fertilizer from which such things as compassion and real love arise. The Buddha actually gave this simile. It was just like these beautiful white lotuses, which in Buddhism was the purest, most beautiful flower, you know, in India. And always said they grow in the mud, in the bottom of the river or the pond, in the real dirty mud. And the more stinky and smelly that mud is, the more beautiful and fragrant is the lotus. But you know, some lotuses don't make it. They get stuck in the mud. Just like many people get stuck in the past, in the pain. And they don't know how to use that as the fertilizer. They grow up. They grow through the mucky water, up to the top, and then through into the sunlight. And that's a beautiful simile, 26 centuries ago, of Buddhism, of how you can be in the dirt, in the shit, and really grow out of it, and become some beautiful white lotus, fragrant, and just so, what it might call, so brilliant and beautiful. And they're all born in the shit, in the mud, of the pain of the past. So this is actually how we see some value in what happened to us. When we see some value, there's purpose. It answers that great question which so many people ask when something terrible, bad happens to you. Why me? Why did this happen? Why did I lose my kid? Why did he commit suicide? Why did I lose my job? Why did my husband do this to me? And that question, why, is a great cause of pain and suffering to people. But now you know the answer. Why do the mobile phones go off? Now you know the answer. Because that's what they do. That's what they're meant to do. And you can't all turn them off. How many people in the room? The laws of probability. It was that person's turn this time. Next week it'll be your turn. So do you get embarrassed when you make a mistake like that? Don't get embarrassed. It's just what happens in life. So you don't feel guilty and beat yourself up, which a lot of people do when they make a mistake. They feel so embarrassed, beat themselves up, and just get further into guilt. But instead, that was meant to be. So thank you for doing that today. As I say thank you to my girlfriend for dumping me. Thank you for their boss for cheating on you. Because if you're really, really wealthy, you would never have enough pain or disappointment or problems actually to come to a place like this. Most of you came here not because you were having a good time, but because you were desperate. So whoever it was who made you so desperate, who traumatized you, and made you come here, go back to them and say, thank you so much. That's actually true. People used to tell me in Thailand this. They said the only time you came to a temple in Thailand is when you're having a lot of problems and suffering. And they said they were so afraid of going to the temple because they thought the biggest suffering which people have in life is relationships. So these women, whenever they went to a temple in Thailand, they said they were afraid because their friends would think, she's going to the temple. There must be some problem in their life. That must mean her husband. That must mean he's sleeping with somebody else. You know how gossip goes on and on and on. So they wouldn't like going to the temple because the rumor in the village would be that their husband is misbehaving. But some of you come here because of that, and what a wonderful thing that was. So instead of getting angry at the past, we're actually honest to it. We embrace it. But we don't take the pain of the past with us. It's the pain part which we let go of. We acknowledge it. Yes, it happened. The pain, the anger, the wanting to seek justice, the wanting to seek revenge, the wanting to punish, that is what we let go of. The wanting to punish Osama. The wanting to punish whoever else caused you pain and problems. The wanting to have prisons which are just for revenge. Let's punish those people who've done such bad things in our world. And unfortunately, whenever I read that in the newspapers, you know, this idea of people, you know, outside the prisons saying, yes, justice has been done, they got 20, 30 years. Or they should have got more. They're saying, well, they're going to be alive when they come out in 10 years' time. But me, you know, my daughter, my son who was killed, they will never be here. They're gone. It's unfair. Come on, why do we live in a society which is so cruel, which seeks for punishment? That does not solve anything. There's a document which I've got in my heart. I keep many of these. And it was relating, it was a study which was done. It was a very beautiful and informative study of the punitive nature of some of our societies and the much more psychologically advanced responses of other societies. And it was concerning, they use as an example, a horrendous thing which happened in the north of England many years ago. I still remember one of the perpetrators, Jamie Bulger. He was a little, about 6 or 7 year old kid who was abducted by, you know, also children in a shopping centre in the north of England, tortured and killed. You know, by two kids, I think about 9 or 10 years of age or something. And of course, that became huge media fodder in UK. The two kids were sentenced to jail. Eventually, they were young, so that when they came to maturity, the sentence was over, they had to be released. The media was saying these people should never be released. What they've done is terrible. And there was so much anger and revenge, especially from, you know, the family of the little kid who was killed. But in contrast, I think it was about the same year, maybe within 18 months, there was a very similar act which happened in Norway, around the town of Trondheim. And there was a couple of other kids who'd taken a young girl into the snowfields and brutally killed her. And it was so similar, the circumstances of the act. You know, two elderly kids taking a younger kid and killing them. But the response was so different. And I must say the Norwegian response was much closer to being Buddhist. The next day, after they caught the perpetrators of those killers, the next day, both of those killers were in school. With psychologists, with social workers in attendance. And the family of the murdered girl had no thought of revenge. They realized that those two kids who did this, they were kids. basically that their neural system was not responsible in the same way an adult was. Basically, they did not have the same sense of what they were doing, as if, you know, an adult, mature 21-year-old or 25-year-old would. So even the family of the murdered girl did not really want to have those two murderers put in jail. Straight away, they did not want their eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. And those two kids, they needed huge amounts of psychological support. And many years later, when the parents of Jamie Borger, or whoever it was still in a lot of pain, the parents of this girl, they were just going on with their life, totally at peace, free from the pain of that past. When it's punitive, anger, guilt, when we refuse to let it go because we want justice, there will never be any freedom. And that case study was so beautiful because those two cases happened about the same time. They were similar enough, but the different response showed very clearly what we should really be doing with the pain of our past. If you want to punish, if you feel guilty, if you're angry, if you want to hurt that person who hurt you, or you want to hurt yourself because of something you did, that complexity of your past, that pain of the past, will mean you will never, ever be free. There'll be no possibility for you. And the Buddha said that 26 centuries ago, my goodness sake. Other religions, they are punitive. Now, God punishes, you know, the evil ones. You know, we don't even have a word called evil in Buddhism. Stupidity, yes, but not evil. You see the difference there? Stupidity can be healed. Evil is, you know, needs to be burnt at the stake. That's what we used to do. But stupidity, counseling, compassion, learning, growth, that's how we overcome stupidity. It's rehabilitation. So that gives a totally different sort of explanation to what happens. And with that different explanation to what happens, a totally different way forward out of that pain of the past. And of course, many of you have actually come here because you've had the pain of the past, and you're forgiven, you're loved, you're cared for, and you're encouraged to do the same for yourself and for other people. That means that pain of the past can be let go of. That's how it's let go of. That's how we remove that. Doesn't matter what you've done in the past or what's happened to you. Acknowledge it. Forgive it. No punishment. And we learn. We grow. And that means, as I was meditating just now, and I thought, this is a talk I was going to give, it's like in that past there's sometimes a tension, a tightness. Just like in your body sometimes, that when you start meditating, there's a tension, a tightness. And I taught you how to relax the body. Little by little, being aware and being kind. Awareness, compassion to even parts of the body. And awareness and compassion to the present moment. You're in this present moment, you're kind to it, and it relaxes. You get this beautiful sense of freedom and ease. And today I've told you to do the same thing to your past. Be aware of it. Put your attention right in that past. And be compassionate to it, kind to it. And you find like the emotional feeling of tightness and tension, which sometimes you can feel in your body as an ache or a pain. In the emotional body, that tightness, that tension, that stress, emotional stress located in the past is relieved and eased. This big ball of ache and pain and hurt from your past expands. You are relaxing. I can't think of a better word. Relaxing the past as you relax the body, as you relax into this moment. And when you relax, you feel so at ease. Look at me, my robe has fallen off again. That's how relaxed I am. I could always recall, I went to give a talk over in Crawley. I think it was one of the boat clubs there, or yacht clubs, and they had a little restaurant there. And it was one of these talks. I love going to talks to places I've never been before. And it's one of the interesting things about being a monk. You get all over the place. And this was a group of executives, you know, executives from Perth who met, you know, once a month in this, you know, yacht club, had dinner and wine and all sorts of other stuff. They never gave me anything. Good job, because I can't eat it or drink it. But it was after the talk I gave on, you know, on Buddhism and the sort of attitudes we have. I always remember this executive came up afterward with me and said, yeah, I was listening to what you said and it was very interesting and important, but what I really noticed is your robes and just how loose they were and how they keep falling off. And he said, she said, I take that as a symbol of Buddhism, because she said she was brought up in a Catholic convent where the nuns there were just so tight, nothing ever fell off. And she said it was just so strict and so tight. There was no freedom there. There's no relaxation. There's no ease. If something went wrong, like something fell off, you can't do that. That's wrong. But she saw me in this very loose robe with things falling off. She said, that's Buddhism. Like easy, comfortable. And if things fall off, we learn from that. We accept that. We just put it up again and finish. What's the problem? But if you feel guilty, I've been a monk for 36 years and I still can't keep my robe on when I give a talk. You hopeless, hopeless, hopeless. No, of course, that's just a robe falling off. Have you made mistakes? Have you done things wrong? Have you feel guilty about them? Have you hidden them and just feel terrible? Oh, I did this terrible thing. Why did this happen to me? That's not being a Buddhist. Keep it loose. Keep it free. Let things go wrong. Learn from them. Fix them up and go forward. Such a simple, beautiful teaching. And that simple and beautiful teaching is just what the Buddha said so many years ago. I wanted to sort of quote a couple of suttas, because sometimes people get the impression that Ajahn Brahm makes these things up himself, got nothing to do with what the Buddha taught. But actually it does. This is actually basically what the Buddha taught, but I don't actually, on a Friday night, I don't talk in Sanskrit or Pali, I talk in English. And just put those teachings into modern context. There's something called the Bhaddhekarata Suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is showing I know what I'm talking about. Just, you know, in case there's any doubters there. It just says that just let go of the past. Don't run off into the future. Be kind to the present. This is 2600 years ago. This fellow was talking this in ancient India. Telling people just let go of that past. How you let that go? With kindness. In the Vinaya, the teachings which he gave to the monks, when we make mistakes, when we break the rules, what are we supposed to do? Admit your mistake, acknowledge it. Forgive it, no punishment. Learn from it so you don't do it again. Or do it less often. That is actually how we were trained. Straight from the word of the Buddha 26 centuries ago. That's impressive. Because it works. It creates this beautiful set of a community of people who can make mistakes. We're not afraid to make mistakes. Because we don't have punishment. Are you afraid to make mistakes? And to admit those mistakes? Are you afraid if your robe fell off? If you know what I mean. Of course, when you're afraid to make the mistakes, there's so much tension and tightness in you that you make more mistakes. But when you relax, you have this beautiful sense of body relaxing, the mind relaxing, the past relaxing, even relaxing in the future. Are you worried about the future? What might happen to you? About the biopsy result coming in on Monday? About, you know, the financial or the credit card statement coming in next week? And, oh my God, I know I spent too much. What am I going to do? Are you tight with the future? Have you got this sense of tension lying in front of you somewhere? If you have, you know, you're in a big trouble. Relax. Open up. Be kind, compassionate. You know, there's always something you can do. If you really get financially ruined, look, if you're a man, you can become a monk. If you're a nun, you can become, if you're a woman, you become a nun. We will always feed you. And later on, you know, after many years in the monastery, because you're financially ruined, you couldn't pay your bills. You'll look back and say, oh, that day when I was financially ruined, you know, when the bank took over my house and I was totally without a place to stay or a job or clothes to wear, and Ajahn Brahm took me into the monastery and I became a monk. At the time I thought it was bad, but now I know it was good. good, bad, who knows? And that's a way to look at your future. How many times have you really had a bad news or something really bad happen to you? And at that time you think, this is the end of the world, this is terrible, how am I going to get out of this? And all those really difficult moments of your life which you have faced, and you thought there's no way out, and now you're here. You look back upon those times, and isn't that true? At the time you thought it was bad, and tell, well, that is the problem. It's just the way you judge things, only see the negative side of life. So now, whatever happens to you, good, bad, who knows? Well, great philosophy of life. So it means you can never get angry, you can never get afraid, you never get sort of worried about the past. Whatever happened to you, good, bad, who knows? Whatever's going to happen to you tomorrow, good, bad, who knows? Whatever happened to you now, good, bad, who knows? What a beautiful attitude that is, because that opens up the possibility that every time you are in the shit, it's just a beautiful lotus growing. It's only a matter of time before it breaks through the surface, sees the warm sun, and the lotus gives so much joy to itself and others. That's all that means. Good, bad, who knows? Opening up the opportunity for lotuses to grow in your life from the shit of your disappointments and pain. That's how we deal with the complexities of life. It's very simple. I'm not trying to solve the past, because the past can't be solved. It's just there. Even not trying to understand the past, because it's just too long ago. I don't know, understand exactly what happened or why. Now, what did I do? I would say it sounded like a good idea at the time. Isn't that story of your life? I became a monk? Yeah, sounded like a good idea at the time. You got married to somebody? Yeah, sounded like a good idea at the time. Ooh, maybe good, bad, who knows? So that way you can have this beautiful, peaceful attitude, like Ajahn Brahm's robe. Wear life loosely. Wear the present and allow it to fall off you every now and again. Don't be tight. Relax, open up, be kind, and then you'll be free. That's how we deal with the complexities of a monk's robe, the complexities of your past, present and future. Thank you for listening. Okay, any questions? Okay, Todd, yes. Okay, you're asking, could it happen Osama bin Laden's death without any vengeance? And he gave some very good reasons. It could have happened. You know, the soldiers were just trained to do their jobs, almost like robots, and the generals, you know, had their reasons, and the Obama, because he wanted to be elected, not because out of vengeance. But the point is that most people have reacted as justice has been done. I'm not talking about the people who actually did the job. The way our Western world has viewed sort of that event in terms of vengeance and justice. And when we actually view it in that way, what actually really happened, I don't know, who knows, you know, what went on in the mind of those people. But we, a lot too many people, view it as vengeance and justice, and evil has been taken out from the world. And that, unfortunately, is very sort of Judeo-Christian and Abrahamic. A Buddhist should have a totally different philosophy about that. And unfortunately that some of our Western culture is just dominated by that idea. The eye for an eye and the tooth for a tooth is still alive and well. Only just in a sort of a more a sanitized version. But the general principle is still there. You stole from me, you've got to be punished by going to jail. And you've raped, you've got to be put inside and never released at all. It's not sort of wise, it's just revenge, it's not real justice. And so I was really focusing on that particular part of the talk this evening, on not actually what happened, but how I've read many people respond in the newspapers throughout the world. And it's sad. And of course, that's the way we respond. That's the problem. Yes. Oh, yeah.
Christian teaching with regard to forgiveness is the disciple of Jesus came up to him and said, how many times do I forgive this person? 7 times, maybe complete time. And Jesus said, no, not 7, but 70 times.
Mm.
That's the Christian spirit, the
yeah.
Jewish spirit, the Muslim spirit. I believe that good religion has that at the heart.
I agree with you there. And that's actually from an ex-Christian minister, if you don't mind me saying that. So it's very good. I agree with that. But it's not the Christianity which we hear a lot of the time. Yes. I agree with you there. And that's the sort of Christianity we want to hear. That's the sort of Islam we want to hear. That's the sort of Judaism we want to hear. But, you know, sometimes, again, I read in a newspaper, there was this 91-year-old fellow who was accused in Germany of being part a guard in one of those extermination camps during the Second World War, and still wanted to punish him. And that doesn't make any sense to me at all. And so that is actually the judicial system which we have in this country, you know, putting people in jail for punishment and having mandatory sentencing. And just, you know, wanting to sort of hurt the bad guys. I mean, that is part of our society. And it'd be wonderful, you know, if the mainstream Christians, Jews and Buddhists and everything joined together and saying that that is not the teaching which we understand and recognize from our religion. So I applaud what you said, and that's how Christians should behave. But my goodness, there's very few actually do that. Yeah, good. Unfortunately, I did read that the Dalai Lama had gone on record and saying no, it was he shouldn't go around killing people like Osama bin Laden. No, he's going to get into a lot of criticism for that. But I really applaud things like that. I applaud forgiveness. I applaud like learning, not just as some people actually criticise and say, oh, you're just being impractical, Ajahn Brahm, if you read that. The Osamas in the world go free, there'll just be more violence, they'll take that as weakness, blah, blah, blah. But you know, it's forgiveness, but then doing something about it to make sure it doesn't happen again. Having those strategies which follow forgiveness and peace. Forgive, yes. But that's not the end of the story. You know, if someone has done something wrong to you, forgive. But, you know, if you just forgive, then it's going to happen again. Why did that happen? Find out some deeper meaning. That person stole from you is because, you know, they had a bad upbringing or because they're really poor, they're desperate. Do you all remember that sort of the Les Miserables, the actual story behind that? And just, what was his name, Jean? Ah, I forget. Sorry? That's right, Valjean. Jean Valjean. You know, he stole because his family were poor. He stole a loaf of bread. Because his family were starving, and he got put in the prison ship in the prison system. It's a powerful little book, that, when I first read that, Victor Hugo's book. Because it didn't sort of say that crime, you know, was good, but understood why it happened. And just how punitive the world was at that time. If something like that happened, they stole a loaf of bread because they were hungry. Gee, there must be some way that I can find a loaf of bread to give him, rather than punish him. Anyway, I think you understand the meaning. I'll take what you say on board. Which is very good. Yes, at the back. He's asking just why, just unlike my father, the other people, they say that's their reality, and they sort of take on that pain, and often they revisit it on other people. And I think one reason is, I think it's because many people in our society, we don't recognize the alternative. We don't offer that to people as another way of dealing with the trauma and pain of their lives. And it's also almost sometimes we're expected to be angry. And I mention this because it brings back another anecdote. I'll just go through this quickly. Must be about 15 years ago now. You know, I was teaching down in our Armadale group. And after the talk, one woman wanted to have some counselling. She said, no, other people said, give her this time because she's really in a big problem. And her problem was she just found out that day that her husband had been sexually abusing her two 11-year-old twins. That's a big problem. And they found out at school, the signs were there. The teacher was smart enough to see there was something wrong with these two kids. School psychologists interviewed them. Sure enough, they had been sort of sexually raped by their father. And the mother was traumatized too because her duty of care. These were the kids she loved. And how on earth did she let this happen? She was blaming herself. And of course, this was a man she trusted and loved. And before that time, she thought she had a good relation with him. But now her whole world was upside down. And of course, the kids had to go through counselling, she had to go through counselling, but because she heard teachings, just like here, she was given another way of dealing with it. And eventually, she said, I could never sort of love that man again, but I don't want to punish him. I want to move on, for my sake and for my kids' sake. And so when she actually went to see the counsellor, which was mandatory, the counsellor would not let her finish the sessions, because she was not admitting any anger. And the counsellor was actually thinking that she was in denial, she wasn't being honest to herself. And she had to come to me, and I had to write a long letter to the counsellor, actually explaining that this lady, as she's gone through it, she's dealt with the problem very quickly, much quicker than you're used to, but she has no anger to her husband. She's not in denial, she's honest, she's open, she knows what's happened. She doesn't want to have this hurt her and her kids anymore. She's moved on. And only through that letter was she released from counselling. I've kept in touch with her. She sent a letter about a year ago at Christmas. I sent her a Christmas card back. Kids have grown up. Her daughter is married with a kid. And totally sort of at ease with their lives. But sometimes that she was almost obliged to get angry, because the system expected it of her at that time. That's one of the reasons why people carry it around. Because they think there's no other option. They think forgiving, especially forgiving themselves, can't be done. I must feel guilty. Another quick case is one of the prisoners from our local prison farm who helped work at our John Grove Retreat Centre. He was there for 2 years, great guy, many of you may have met him, came up for parole. It was a sexual abuse case. Apparently, what I heard, it might be wrong, his parole was refused because he did not show enough remorse. He was a Buddhist, he knew what he'd done, he was open about it, but he'd moved forward. He didn't feel guilt, but he was punished because he'd let go of guilt, by a system which does not recognize that such a possibility. If he showed remorse, as if he was punishing himself, he'd probably be out on parole now. That's my view. Do you get the picture there? I think too many people don't understand there is another alternative. We're just too punitive, guilty. I think if the Christian priests and the Muslim mullahs and everyone else just said, just thinks how many times should a person be forgiven? 7 times 70. How many, that be merciful, forgive. That's, somewhere in the Quran. Wouldn't that be a wonderful world? So anyway, that's a possibility. And that's a possibility hopefully I've opened up for you and everyone who listens to this talk. Look at the another possibilities. Not guilt, not punishment, not violence. But be so kind to that past, it becomes like a monk's robe. Loose, able to be let go of. I'm not held tightly. Okay, that's given you something to think about, and you must be interested because most of you have stayed. We've gone on 10 minutes longer. Usually in an ordinary talk, you're out of the door by now. So you must have really liked the talk this evening. So thank you so much for listening.